Rhythm Channel One Radio.
Rhythm Channel One Radio.
Brought to you by McCary Media and Entertainment.
Stay on the music.
You're in the mix with Rhythm Channel One Radio.
Rhythm Channel One on YouTube.com.
Let's talk music.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for listening in. This time, I have the pleasure of speaking with guitar impresario Marlo Henderson. Marlo is celebrating over 50 years as a professional musician. He's played with Buddy Miles, Taj Mahal, Michael Jackson, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Minnie Riperton, LaBelle, Patrice Rushen, the Gap Band, and so many more. You'd have to see his discography to believe the talent he has worked with. Marlo, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Thank you so much for dialing in. I do appreciate your time. And I actually want to begin by congratulating you on 50 years as a professional musician.
Thank you very much. It's very uncommon for anybody to do anything for 50 years. So it's like having fun for 50 years, doing what I love to do. It's like a super blessing.
And you have been busy creating a super legacy with the guitar. Your legacy with the guitar is very special. And so is your legacy, by the way, with the world of music making and songwriting. So thanks for the hits, man. Also, I absolutely have to send a shout-out to your PR company for making this happen. And I want to congratulate you on those exciting projects you're working on, which we'll talk about toward the end of the show. So let's get started. You have a master's degree in music, and you've been a professional musician since the 70s, traveled all over the world and worked with the best of the best in the music world. You've taught me and mentored me, and I just can't imagine how different all the hits you've played your guitar on would sound had you never picked up a guitar. But you started off playing sax?
Well, formally I started taking saxophone lessons in school at about seven, eight years old, so that means the second or third grade. And I was actually looking to follow in the footsteps of my father. He was a saxophonist.
I see.
And that was great. I owned my first instrument at four. He gave me a C melody, and I used to drag it around in the dirt and try to figure out what was going on with it. And, you know, listen to him play the end, that whole thing. So it was like, it was predestined.
I see. So you grew up watching your father play the horn. You wanted to play the horn.
Oh, absolutely.
How did you make that migration to the guitar?
When I got old enough or good enough to start playing in little local bands around, I found a fascination for the guitar. So I started playing. My first guitar was a Mickey Mouse club guitar. Like, you know, the one with the ears.
But this
was the real one. It was like wood. It was made from wood, not the plastic ones that came along later.
And so it actually had a sound.
It actually was a guitar. I wish I had it now. Or who knows what. But that was my first guitar, and I was playing saxophone. And I would play a little more and more and more. There were people who were around in the community who had guitars, so I started borrowing or asking them to let me play, and that's how I learned. You know, and I had a really good friend who fancied being a bass player. And he and I would learn parts on songs like James Brown or whoever. We'd listen to the records and try to emulate what we heard. So that's how that all started. And it got mm-hmm. to a point to where I could do gigs and play saxophone and guitar. And finally, I don't know, I must have been about 12, 13 years old. I've been playing with a guy. Now, I'm from New Mexico, so there are a lot of small towns, communities around New Mexico. So sometimes somebody lived 50 miles away, 60 miles away, 100 miles away. So we didn't see each other every day. So it was restricted to weekends and mostly summers. So there's this one guy who I can actually name as my first mentor. His name was Raydell Clay. Raydell played guitar. And I was so fascinated with how he played and how he sounded, and it inspired me to be a guitar player. And this is a really, really funny story, and it's life. I mean, it's life on steroids. In the summer, when Raydell would come over from his hometown to visit with his sister, which was maybe about 100 miles away from where I lived, I worked out a deal with him to let me every Saturday morning come over and play his guitar, because I didn't own an electric guitar as of yet. So every Saturday morning, by 10 o'clock, I'd go over and I'd bang on his guitar. And so one week, I was just anticipating going over and trying out all this stuff for the in my head and all that I could imagine, and it was one of those times that, wow, I'm just going to do this, I'm going to do that, and I get there, I knock on the door, he answers the door, I says, well, I'm ready, he says, well, you can't play guitar today, I go, why not, he says, I have a girl. Now, you have to understand, I was maybe about 12, 13, so he had to be maybe 16, 17.
So
he says, I have a girl over here, and I'm saying, what does that mean?
I know, I don't care about the girl. Give me the guitar.
Let me play the guitar. Well, you can't come in, this is okay. And I remember saying to him, I said, well, you know what? I'm going to play guitar. I'm going to be better than you, and you're going to be sorry that you didn't let me play today.
So it made you
Fast
so mad.
It shot me into space somewhere. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't imagine, you know, I just didn't have it together. Girl, what's the girl got to do with my learning how to play guitar? Mm-hmm. Fast forward maybe 10 years. I had played with Buddy. We'd gone around
Buddy
the world.
Miles.
Buddy Miles. And we now had a group called Max Ann, a group that Andre Lewis and I started.
How
Max
long
Ann
did you
Lewis.
Play with Buddy?
Played with Buddy 2 years, it seemed like 20 at times. But it was,
okay.
It was 1970 to 1972. We did a lot of touring, and we did, I don't know, during that period, 3 or 4 albums.
Was that the connection that brought you to California?
No, the connection that brought me to California, I was living in Denver, and it got to the point where, and this is in 1969, I felt that I'd done enough in Denver, and I wanted to broaden my horizons. So it was a touring cost. I'm going to leave here and either go to New York, you know, leaving Denver, or go to Los Angeles. And it was virtually a touring cost. And it ended up my coming to L.A. And I knew...
So you came to L.A. from Denver.
From Denver, Colorado. That's an interesting period in my life in that I met a very close friend. We're close friends today. Billy Rich. Billy Rich is a bass player who
Billy Rich.
Had played with Buddy. He knew Jimi Hendrix. He's currently playing with Taj Mahal. He's played with Taj Mahal for the most part of, 45 years.
Wow.
But through him, I met Hendrix. I didn't meet Buddy Miles through him, but I did meet Jimi Hendrix through him. So Jimmy and I had a relationship from, maybe 1968.
Weren't you just on the brink of performing with him before he tragically passed on?
Well, the spring of that year, 1970, we had done five concerts with him. And there was a plan to do a winter tour with him. And that's what it was. That's how it happened. But we started, I guess, in March, and we did five dates. One was here at the Forum. One was in Sacramento. One was in El Paso, Texas. One was in Arizona, I think, Phoenix. And maybe, Oregon.
I know that had to hit your heart to see that one go down.
Well, it was just very strange. Just at that time, everything was moving extremely fast. Buddy had gotten very popular. We were doing a lot of traveling in Europe, parts of South America, and here. So it was just extremely fast track.
Yeah, and you were right in the thick of it.
Right in the middle of it. And when we got news of it, we were in San Francisco, and we had played the Fillmore West. And we were up after that gig. It might have been a Friday night or Saturday night after the gig, and we were at our manager's house in San Francisco. And the news came over the radio that Jimmy had died. And it was like, what? Mm. Really? You know? So it was quite devastating to us all. And subsequently, we ended up, the entire band went to Seattle for his funeral, and we played at his funeral.
Oh, dear. What was it like working with him? You played five dates with him?
Right. And see, it was interesting because the first time I played with Jimmy, it was a jam in Denver in 1968. He was scheduled to go. This is right after the Monterey Pop Festival, where he made big news and burned his guitar and all that stuff. Well, right after that, he was scheduled to come to Red Rocks in Denver. And like I said, Bill Rich, his brother Herbie, we had a rock and roll band. And Billy's experience was with Buddy. He played with Buddy, and Jimmy wanted Billy to play with him in the experience. He wanted to get rid of Bill Redding in the experience. Right. This is prior to the band of Gypsies. And this is how I got to know Jimmy, because he called Billy all the time. And during that time, if you were at somebody's house during that time, if the phone rang and you were close to it, you just answered.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
This evolved into a relationship over the phone between Jimmy and I, because he'd ask me, like, you know, why won't Billy play with me? I said, I didn't know, you know.
Wow.
And he says, I keep calling him, I send him money, he sends the money back, and I'm like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. So that's how we established our relationship, and he came to Denver to play at Red Rocks. And every Friday, our little band would play in the park. It was a park in Denver that was quite popular. And we'd play Friday evenings, you know, Friday afternoon in this park. Well, Friday evening. And this particular Friday, Jimmy came. He came. He found us. He knew where we were. He came. And he sat in. And he started playing. And then people started to realize who he was. So he had to escape. He had to leave.
Okay.
Because it was a contractual situation. He couldn't play within a certain amount of miles within a certain time period. So he had to leave. Mm-hmm. So that was actually the first time that I got a chance to jam with him.
Well, speaking of jamming and your career highlights, that would have to be, working with Jimi Hendrix would definitely have to be one of the highlights of the 70s. Tell me a few of the highlights from your career from the 80s and the 90s. You have worked with some of my favorite artists, the Gap Band, the Pointer Sisters. Some of the tracks you played on for them are of my favorites, of their music.
Well, thank you. I want to revisit the 70s for one, make one point about Jimmy and Miles Davis. The first time I went to Harlem was in a limousine with Miles Davis, Jimi Hendrix, Buddy Miles.
Wow.
We had played at Fillmore East, and we had a large band. It was 10, 12 musicians in the band. Mm-hmm. So there was always a line of limos out front when it was time to go. And I'm trying to figure out what car I'm going to get in. So Miles rolled the window down and says, "Get in the car." So that was the car I got in.
Miles Davis. We have to have another show just to talk about your work with Miles.
Miles was different.
Absolutely.
But anyway, that was a highlight. Now, the 80s were a little different, a little toned down. By that time, digital music was starting to make a big play on the scene. I met a man and his wife on Hollywood Boulevard one day, and they wanted to know, and I could tell that they were European because of their accents, they wanted to know where Warner Brothers was. I gave them directions to get there, and that was it. At the time, I was living in Burbank, very close to Warner Brothers. And maybe two or three days later, I see these people again. They've moved into this apartment, so we start dialogue. They were from Stockholm, and he'd invented a way to do subtitling that was more advanced than what they were using at that time. So he stayed here. He did his business. And before he and his wife left and went back to Stockholm, he asked me, "Do you compose music?" I said, "Yeah, I do." He said, "Well, give me some of the stuff if you will, and I'll see what I can do." So I gave him a few cassettes of some of the music.
To the gentleman from Stockholm.
From the gentleman from Stockholm, and I'm trying to remember his name now because it's been such a long time ago. But at any rate, maybe about 2 weeks later, I get a call in the middle of the night, and it's him. And he's telling me that he'd taken the music to someone at a film company, and they were very interested in a lot of the music. And what did I feel about, coming to Stockholm and recording some of the music and committing it to film and the whole bit. So it was a whole process, but that was a highlight because
at that time,
there was, as much as I wanted to, I knew no one that could get me into the film industry, even the independent film industry in this country. So all of a sudden, here's a guy that I met on happenstance, and it's funny, happenstance and coincidence is really a joke in that, because everything is pretty much predestined.
Hear.
So that's
the 80s.
Yeah, that's the 80s. I'm commuting back and forth between here and Stockholm, writing, not doing full film scores, but having a lot of music on a lot of their films, and that expanded into a company out of Italy. So seven or eight years.
What about the 90s?
Okay, the 90s. I would have to say playing and recording for Ray Charles.
Mm.
I have a friend, his name is Billy Osborne. He's a brother of Jeffrey
Osborne.
Yeah, that's another show. Anyway, he started writing songs for Ray Charles, and I got a chance to do the demos and the records once Ray approved the songs.
Is he the brother of Jeffrey Osborne?
Yes, he is. He's the brother.
Yeah, they're fantastic
brother.
Writers, both he and his brother. They're fantastic
writers.
So that
was that was a highlight in the 90s because I got a chance to know Ray Charles in a different light. Billy was the first person who actually wrote anything for Ray, more than one song. So there was an interaction between them daily, and I got a chance to be involved in that.
Oh, Marlo, I just have to take a deep breath now. Just listening to you talk is in these stories, and as you know, I'm most familiar. It's wonderful. I am extremely grateful to you for sharing this with the listeners, and I'm going to push on just for time purposes to what you're working on right now, because we'll be wrapping up shortly. Please tell me about the exciting projects going on at marlohenderson.com. I know you've got the Oracle spoken word project and the music that you scored for the play that traveled in throughout China, East Meets West, It's Another Day.
Another Day. Okay, let's start with Denise. Denise is quite extraordinary. She's won the Billboard Top Spoken Word Artist of the Year 2 years in a row. Maybe 2-3 years ago, I co-produced an album on her here at my little place, and it's doing well.
M5 Studios.
Yes.
Altadena, California.
Yes. Nice little place, little homegrown place. It's very comfortable. The neighborhood is very comfortable.
You wrote one song on her CD?
No, I wrote and produced maybe five. I can't remember exactly.
Fantastic.
One of the songs that we co-wrote together, she just finished shooting a video a couple of weeks ago.
It's available online, The Oracle. Denise Cook, The Oracle. That's it. And it's available online at Amazon.com. Now, talk a little bit about the play.
Okay, the play, East Meets West, There's Another Day, is a combination of historical and entertainment information dealing with the interactions between the U.S. and China. The first part of the play deals historically with the Chinese coming over and helping build the railroad. And then there's a section that we deal with the Flying Tigers when the United States came over to China to help them fight the Japanese.
Exactly. And you scored the music for all of these scenes.
For all the scenes, yes. And then also
is the project coming to the United States?
At some point it will. Don't know. There's plans, but nothing concrete. But what we're doing now is doing 7 weeks in China, doing seven cities a week in each city in China, and promoting that. And what it is, it's a great kind of little story, because you get into the historical things, and then from that it goes into entertainment. So we have lookalikes, soundalikes. We have a Michael Jackson. We have a Marilyn Monroe. We have, well, of course, we have Kissinger, Nixon. We have Frank Sinatra. We have Tina Turner. And I know that there's somebody that I'm leaving out.
So these are like collections of individual performances that become part of the collective of the play.
Right. And they all deal with the correlation between China and the United States, because the Chinese, they know of these people. Hmm. They know of these particular entertainments. And there are other acts from the United States, but there also are Chinese acts that are in the play as well.
You spent quite a bit of time auditioning talent in Shanghai, did you not?
Yes. Yes.
What was your impression of the talent that you saw there?
There's a tremendous amount of talent.
I know.
The Western enthusiasts, they have taken what they could hear and what they could see from our culture, and they're emulating so much of it. Not to mention their culture, their music. But it's mind-boggling. It's overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. The voices that I hear coming across the ocean and the music. You know, I'm big on SoundCloud, MySpace, and YouTube. They're amazing music, amazing voices.
And
that had to be special for you to see that talent.
Yeah, to see that. And that's only in Shanghai. I mean, we couldn't, I mean, just in China, it would take a year just to go to 10 of the largest cities there. There's just so much talent. And we turned away.
And China's so large.
Oh.
Well, I have to tell you, my friend, this is part one of five. This conversation will be continued. Your boys are well, the Henderson tribe, Paulo, Lance, Charles, and Jeffrey. You guys got any family projects? Because you know how bad I want to see you all on one stage together.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you for getting into that.
That's a dream.
Yes, it is.
I do. I want to see that.
Individually, they're fine. Jeffrey lives in New Mexico, so he's doing what he does in New Mexico. Charles is here. He's doing what Charles does. And all of them are doing what they're doing. Paulo recently is living in Austin, Texas, getting a bit of that experience.
Well.
So they're all well. They're all well. They're all doing what they do.
I'm going to close with something fabulous that you said to me. So when I came to your studio to visit, you talked about guitars, and you said they are beautiful works of art. They create beautiful works of art. We just have to pick one up and get to know it. Thank you.
You're welcome, and the pleasure's all mine.
Everyone, thank you for dialing in. Please send your comments to RCO Radio at ca.rr.com, and you can reach out to Marlo at www.marlohenderson.com. Thank you so much, Marlo. Love you much.
You're still very welcome back.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's go!
This is Rhythm Channel 1 Radio.
Visit Rhythm Channel 1 on YouTube.com.
Let's talk music.
You're in the mix with Rhythm Channel 1 Radio.
Rhythm Channel 1 Radio. Rhythm Channel 1.